This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I say that every day, so casually, but this may be the year where we say, thanks so much for listening, National Security Apparatus, NSA, whoever else out there is listening, Google, get on the list, join the bandwagon. Edward Snowden's classified disclosures and subsequent revelations about government surveillance suggest that we can be watched, that we are being listened to at any moment, so thanks for that. In our commercial lives, everything we buy or even consider buying can be tracked from our purchases right down to our eye movements. Thanks for that. And soon with the ability to remote monitor my heart data and vital signs, the cloud will be listening to my heartbeat, know all about my health, lots more. So here's Edward Snowden crowing, intelligently analyzing his role in all this, engaging in hyperbole and self-marketing. You decide. In an interview with the Washington Post, Edward Snowden recently told reporter Barton Gellman, quote, "For me, in terms of personal satisfaction, the mission's already accomplished. I already won. As soon as the journalists were able to work, everything that I'd been trying to do was validated. Because remember, I didn't want to change society. I wanted to give society a chance to determine if it should change itself." Headline there, privacy is over. Who do we thank for that? Probably not Edward Snowden. But perhaps, and maybe, our outmoded, naive expectation of privacy really does need a new look, a fundamentally different conversation. That's our mission today. Joel Brenner is a former NSA Inspector General and author of Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World. Joel, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Here in the studio with me is Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard Law School, who served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. Susan, welcome.
Great to be here.
And also with us is Nita Farahani, who's a professor of law, genomics, and policy at Duke University. Professor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Professor. How much do you think our notion of privacy has changed the way we think about our private health data? And start with Edward Snowden or anywhere you want to begin.
So, it's interesting because I think health data is one area in which we have the greatest protection. And yet, even that protection is coming under challenge as we move into the electronic world. And that's whether you think about health records where we try to link them up between different electronic databases so that at any given time, hundreds of people have access to your electronic health information. Or if you think about the new wave of personal health trackers, where there are millions of applications that people already have on their smartphones, devices that they carry around with them that are electronically transmitting information that don't get the same kind of protection as health information traditionally does, and that information is widely shared. So, I think even in the most protected area, there's a move away from privacy and toward sharing. And that move is actually a quite good one for consumer health because it enables us to have much greater access to information that could improve our lives.
So, Susan Crawford, if there's a control room, a situation room in the White House where instead of watching people's movements, all right, in terms of national security, they were actually monitoring the public health of Americans using some of the health data that Nita Farahani was talking about. That seems to me to be a positive sort of end of privacy moment. How do you see this? Privacy is fundamentally different today.
We're going through a data revolution that's even more intense than the initial launch of the commercial internet. With all the sensors embedded in products in our streets and everything around us that are context aware, we can be tracked, but we can also be helpfully watched. So we're entering into an era when we worry now about oversight and checks on this kind of information collection. But there are lots of benefits to society that come from it.
That Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. She also served as President Obama's Special Assistant for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy. We're talking about the death of privacy in America in 2013. We get to the national security guy last in this panel, and I'm wondering if the government is sort of late to this game on some level technologically, that the Googles of the world and the sort of cell phone networks of the world preceded it.
You know, the data doesn't divide up into categories so easily. We're talking about national security data or health data or other kinds of data. It's all data. And you can't pick and choose the parts of it that you want to be easily moved around and the parts that you don't want to be easily moved around and available. It's all moves around like comet dust. And whenever privacy comes in conflict with convenience, convenience wins hands down every time. So that we are finding this new world, even though it makes us uneasy, frankly, irresistible. The government's data, which is so troublesome now to so many people, is going to be relatively easy to regulate. The government's ability can be made transparent and can be regulated, whereas what we do with consumer data, I think, is going to be much harder to come to grips with. And yes, we are in a transparent world, whether we like it or not.
Former NSA Inspector Joel Brenner. Susan Crawford here in the studio is vigorously shaking her head. What do you have to say to that?
We're right that the same technology that enables the NSA snooping also enables extensive consumer surveillance. But the government can take your life and constrain your freedom. So we should keep our focus on real oversight of what's going on at the government level. And so far, those protections aren't in place.
But the irony here is that the government can also save your life in terms of its access to and ability to mobilize on the level of public health. Nita Farahani, isn't that one of the real ironies here? This data can be used to save as well as to arrest and incarcerate.
Yeah, it certainly can. And it isn't just the government, of course, who can have access to that data. It is also private companies who can have access to that data. So as people start to share their information much more broadly, like just a simple example, there are basic heart rate monitors, and there are now online EEG devices that enable people to measure brain waves. And for somebody who is an epileptic, it can actually predict before a person has an epileptic seizure that they're about to have an epileptic seizure. And that person may be willing to give monitoring information either over to their health insurance provider or over to a monitoring company, just like we have our alarm systems at our homes monitored. And by doing so, they can get an alert on their iPhone telling them, you know, hey, you need to slow down, you need to take your medication, you may be about to suffer from an epileptic attack. That's wonderful. You know, that's a terrific innovation that by giving simple, basic information about what's happening immediately about your health, you could prevent an insulin shock or an epileptic attack or even a heart attack that might occur. So there are real benefits to sharing information. And I think Joel's right. The convenience, especially if you have a health condition, overwhelms any desire for privacy in these types of situations.
Although if I hacked into such a system and realized that the pilot of the plane I was flying on was about to have an epileptic seizure, it could certainly be a destabilizing moment for all the passengers if I start screaming, right?
Not just an epileptic seizure. You know, there's a lot more that you can start to measure than just epilepsy. So there are a tremendous number of brain-based devices that are coming online. Some of them are invasive and implanted in the brain. Some of them are, you know, wearable gadgets that are part of the fitness revolution. Most of those transmit information via Bluetooth to iPhones, and most of them don't have much security yet. And so it's pretty easy, you know, much easier than even hacking into an iPhone is going to be hacking into somebody's brainwave device. And while right now the kind of information that we can glean from that is pretty limited, as neuroscience becomes better, that type of information will get even better. So I think it's right to be concerned. I'm not just concerned about government access of that information. I'm concerned about ensuring that people understand what kind of information private companies are accessing and what they could do with it. They may not be able to take your life, but they can certainly hike up premiums. They can certainly target you for particular advertisements. And there's a great convenience for that. But there's also some worry about the misinformation that could be gathered about you and misinformation that could be traded and sold about you.
As a sort of a tagline here, I'm wondering if the three of you could comment on something our listeners say repeatedly. And, you know, a lot of people are very, very nervous about all of this and express the same kinds of anxieties and concerns that you've expressed. But there's a segment of our audience that also says, you know what, it's going to make people more honest. I don't have anything to hide. So go ahead, listen in. It's going to make people more honest and above board. Joel?
Well, hypocrisy is harder to pull off in a transparent world. And that's definitely true. It's harder to hide things, whether it's personal health issues or marital affairs or bad behavior. It's harder to hide things, but it's also harder to hide things that are embarrassing and that traditionally we've felt are nobody else's business.
Susan Crawford, a more honest, unprivate world?
I think it's important to take the long view. If information is never forgotten, then someone can use something about your past in a way that might be very disruptive to your life. So that's why oversight is going to be essential.
Nita Farahani, you can have the last word.
I think it's true that oversight is important. My concern is really about squelching creativity, because if it's true that nothing is ever private, if it's true that there's no freedom for people to be able to have outlandish ideas, we have to be worried and ensure that we create a space for people to be creative and different in this transparent world.
Nita Farahani is professor of law, genomics, and policy at Duke University. Susan Crawford is a visiting professor at Harvard Law School. And Joel Brenner is a former NSA inspector general and author of Glass Houses, Privacy, Secrecy, and Cyber Insecurity in a Transparent World. Thanks to the three of you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
So it's the last Friday of 2013, a good year or a bad year? We've heard lots of stories from you over the past 2 weeks about that, but that's not really the question, is it? I mean, the big question is, are you peaking if it's a good year? Are you just getting started and the best years are ahead of you? Or this is it, best years behind me, downhill from here? That's a more profound question, right?
Hey, this is Bruce from Tallahassee, Florida. And yeah, the best years of my life are behind me, and I say that because I've accomplished more in my life than I ever dreamed of, and done more and been to more places, really, than I ever expected, and now I'm going to ease into a quiet and peaceful retirement, so I think the coming years won't be nearly as meaningful as what has happened before.
Let's all go visit Bruce, or one of you in Louisville, Kentucky. My best years are way behind me. The only good thing to be said about getting old is that it's better than the alternative. But here's an alternative from one of you reaching a milestone.
Hi, this is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. I certainly believe that the best years of my life are to come. I'm turning 50 next February, and in this past year, I chose to give up alcohol. I think that's been the best decision of my life. It's completely turned everything in my world around to a positive way. So my next decade is going to be the decade of joy and success.
Go, Kev. Best years in front or behind? Anybody? Anybody?
My name is Julie. I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. And in response to your question about the best years being ahead or behind me, as I'm getting close to 50, I'm struggling a lot with this question, and I've spent a lot of years and months contemplating it. I've come to the conclusion that whether the best is truly yet to come is pretty much up to me. But the next question is, how do I make the years ahead of me better than the years behind?
Thanks, Julie. Later this hour, philosophy professor Todd May will explore this question. Share your story about what you consider your best years. Are they in front or behind you at 8778MYTAKE or at facebook.com/thetakeaway. More voices on pretty good years and bad years throughout the show, including the voice of Ryan Coogler, director of Fruitvale Station, 27 years old. Had a very good year. This is The Takeaway. A ceasefire in South Sudan is holding that country together. Regional mediators in East Africa have been attempting all week to stabilize a conflict that prompted the United Nations to send thousands of peacekeeping troops into Juba and other disputed cities in South Sudan. The ceasefire was announced in Nairobi, and it may start the process that will eventually bring the country's former vice president and opposition leader, Riek Machar, to the peace table with South Sudan's president, Salva Kiir. Regional players in East Africa may have influence in this conflict from decades of confronting chaos, famines, and cross-border wars in Somalia, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. Jendaya Fraser is former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs and distinguished public service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Professor, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be back.
So let's talk about the first question. Is the promise of nationhood really unraveling in this fledgling nation of South Sudan?
Well, in many ways, the promise of nationhood, I think, is one that will be only realized over the long term. This is a country that has more than 200 ethnic groups. It's a country that came to its liberation or independence through civil war of 22 years with the northern government. And many of these militia groups that you see today operating were formerly backed by the Khartoum government. So certainly, nationhood is a dream yet to be achieved. But I think that the current conflict is more political, and therefore it can be resolved through dialogue.
How optimistic are you about the regional players and the talks that have already taken place?
Well, I think that the best hope for the Republic of Southern Sudan is or South Sudan is actually the regional mediation which has taken place. All of these countries are very familiar with South Sudan's history as well as the key players there. Kenya was with the United States helped to mediate the comprehensive peace agreement, which actually led to the government being able, the Republic of South Sudan being able to move to autonomy in 2005 and then to its independence in 2011. Ethiopia has forces on the ground, which also gives it added leverage. And Uganda played a strong role in terms of supporting the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, which is a ruling party over all of these years until it became independent in 2011. So President Museveni of Uganda knows the two main protagonists, Salva Kiir, the president, as well as Riek Machar, his deposed vice president.
Is there an ethnic element here that could turn this into a Rwanda?
Well, there is an ethnic element. This is primarily a political fight, and it's an intra-party political fight insofar as this is the division within the Sudan People's Liberation Movement. And on both sides, you have all of the ethnic groups. So there are at least 11 detained senior officials of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement who Salva Kiir has put into jail, but they are from multi-ethnic groups. But the ethnic division that you find is especially between the Dinka and the Nuer. And that's, of course, the ethnic group. The president is Dinka and his deposed vice president is Nuer. And there's been a long coming feeling that the Dinka have, you know, controlled the government and controlled the resources. So I think that there is within the population some resentment against the Dinka and a divide between Nuer and Dinka. But this is really a political fight.
But is the fact that the vice president, Machar, and President Kiir so associated with those ethnicities, does it make it difficult for them to transcend this and really find a leadership protocol to really bring people together?
Yeah, I think violence can get out of hand, and communities can go into reprisals against each other for assumed harms, both current in terms of the violence that have broken out from December 15th, but there's been an insurrection taking place throughout Sudan since earlier this year, from April, May of this year. And so certainly communities can become hardened against each other. That's a very dangerous development because it's hard for either Salva to control that or Riek to control that. So, yes, I do think that there is a major threat of things getting out of hand.
Does the oil wealth help South Sudan? We've certainly seen that in Nigeria, for instance, the wealth, the formidable wealth of oil that's in Nigeria benefits a tiny, tiny fraction of the country. What's the verdict on the oil wealth in South Sudan in the early going here?
Well, so far, it hasn't been of much help. 98% of their exports are based on oil. And the Sudan, the ruling party, took a decision earlier this year in which they basically shut in the oil because they felt that the North wasn't giving them the right, fees for using their oil. And so they shut it in. And so that potential wealth for the country as a whole hasn't been realized, certainly. Moreover, the oil has led to many allegations of corruption among the ruling party officials. And so there you have another one of the grievances of those who are in rebellion is that not only that the Dinka are dominating, but that the SPLM as a ruling party has become largely corrupt. And so they're using that as a basis for their rebellion.
Finally, before we go, is there a role for the U.S. here as a mediator, in a development role, in an actual on-the-ground role here?
Well, the United States has a lot of leverage in South Sudan because we were very much on their side. Secondly, we helped to negotiate The peace agreement, essentially, that led to the end of that 22-year war and set up the agreement that led to South Sudan becoming independent. We know all the parties, and we've also trained the military. And so of all the international actors outside of Africa, the United States has the greatest leverage on certainly Salva Kiir, and to a less degree, but still importantly, Riek Machar. No leader can govern the Republic of South Sudan without support from the United States. And I think that they all realize that.
Jindiah Frazier, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. She's currently a distinguished public service professor at Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Another unraveling, the possibility once again that the Syrian civil war will spill over into Lebanon, has taken the form of a blackened car bomb, a cloud of smoke over the city of Beirut, Lebanon. A terrorist attack has killed a leading opposition figure and former ambassador to the United States, Mohammed Chatta. Chatta, a Sunni Muslim and advisor to former Prime Minister Saad Hariri, also a staunch critic of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Assad is being supported by the Lebanon-based Shia group Hezbollah, the Party of God. Veteran Middle East analyst and former Beirut resident Andrew Tabler joins us now from Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and author of In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. Andrew Tabler, this is a sad day for you, yes?
It is. It is for many, many of us who've been covering the region. I knew Mohammed Chatta, interviewed him countless times. I see him every time I go to Beirut, and it's a big loss for all of us that right on the region and that deal with its political affairs.
Has Hezbollah basically declared war on the supporters of the sort of Sunni factions in Syria who are working inside Lebanon, including people in the Lebanese government?
Yeah, it's a good question. There have been some attacks on Shia neighborhoods, and Hezbollah comes primarily from the Shia sect within Lebanon. There was an attack on the Iranian embassy, and Iran backs Hezbollah. Some people see this as payback. Others see it as perhaps related to the tribunal into the death of late Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in Lebanon, who Mr. Chatta served for so many years. But overall, it sends a message to everyone in Lebanon that they're no longer safe and that the days of the assassinations are back. Lebanon hasn't had a government now for some time. And it'd be interesting to see if these crises push the different parties within the country to form one.
Aside from the stakeholders inside Lebanon who may have, a dog in this fight not to trivialize, who in Syria has an interest in this war spilling over into Lebanon?
Bashar al-Assad, the president there, is holding on despite the activities of the rebels, but he hasn't been able to do so just as he was before. It's a very different regime. Now he's using the full lethality of his arsenal in terms of chemical weapons and Scud missiles, and the American public now knows about that. But also he's invited Hezbollah, Iranian Quds Force, and other Shia militias from Iraq into the country to support his regime. And that has exacerbated and rubbed up against similar tensions and among the Sunni population, both in Syria, where it's the majority, and also within Lebanon. And that's the sect from which Mr. Chatta hails. So it's a real problem in terms of trying to keep the lid on sectarian strife within the region.
So the opposition has essentially forced Bashar al-Assad to rely on the Bekaa Valley and the formerly occupied territories inside Lebanon that for so long were controlled by Syria.
Right. And also now are controlled by Hezbollah. It's true that, for example, there are now extremists among the Syrian opposition, but it's also true that there are extremists among the forces of Bashar al-Assad. Each side has been pushed to extremes, and that's very bad news for the United States and particularly for the Obama administration's policy. We now have not just one Syria, where I used to work, but many Syrias. And in each one of these Syrias, we have U.S. designated terrorist groups that are not just present, but they're ascendant. And that's a threat to U.S. national security interests.
Longtime acquaintance of who we learned today is the late Mohammed Chatta, former ambassador to the U.S. from Lebanon, Andrew Tabler, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Andrew Tabler, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Surely the headlines have provided no shortage of opportunities for documentary filmmakers in 2013, but those films about today's headlines, we'll just have to wait for. In the meantime, 2013 produced some terrific documentaries taken from the headlines from the last few years. Movie Date co-hosts Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are here on our regular Movie Friday, last Friday of 2013. Rafer, film critic for Newsday. Kristen, culture producer for The Takeaway. You can always hear more from them at moviedatepodcast.org. Happy Friday. Happy last Friday.
Hi, too, John.
So on the documentary question, you know, we began this hour talking about Edward Snowden. One of the big documentaries this year was We Steal Secrets by Alex Gibney about Julian Assange. It's almost like, who remembers him? Here's a clip.
Disclosures like these tear at the fabric of responsible government.
We're looking at all of the things that we can do to stem the flow of this information.
This was the biggest leak in the history of this particular planet.
So my name is Julian Assange. I'm the editor of WikiLeaks.
We help you get the truth out. If you get this material, give it to us, no questions asked, and you'll help change history.
WikiLeaks didn't figure in the Edward Snowden affair, but Kristen, you love this movie. Does it hold up?
I absolutely loved it. I just thought it was a fantastic character study. Alex Gibney is great at really delving into people's complexities. In this case, you have somebody who's kind of built up to be sort of a hero for transparency, and then you see Julian Assange is totally great with transparency until it affects his own life and his own privacy and his own secrets. And so it's just a great character study where you're kind of cheering for him at one point, and then you're feeling dirty and wondering why you cheered for him at the end.
This works better than the feature film on Julian Assange
that came out?
Oh,
absolutely, hands down. I think that the feature film was very problematic. It was a little bit scattered. They didn't quite know what to focus on in that one. There are a lot of scenes and dance clubs and just noisy filler. And this one, there is no filler. Every single moment matters in the film. Every word must be. It's a fantastic documentary.
Rafer, Alex Gibney had a busy year in terms of releases. So your favorite is another one of his.
Yes, The Armstrong Lie, where Gibney originally set out to make essentially a puff piece celebrating the comeback of Lance Armstrong, and instead wound up basically tearing him down and showing us how Lance Armstrong basically operated right out in the open with his doping all through the Tour de France.
Let's listen.
Life for me at the time was moving fast. I mean, look at 2005. I had won 7 tours in a row. I was engaged to a beautiful rock star. But that all just felt normal to me. I certainly was very confident that I would never be caught.
Is this of the genre of the sort of Errol Morris access documentary, or is this just sort of at the right place at the right time?
I think it was really just right place, right time. Gibney sort of had to make himself part of this documentary, and you know, he often narrates his own films, but in this one, he really had to talk about how when he first came into the Lance Armstrong story, people really looked at him askance and said, "Why are you helping this guy?" Everyone in the Tour de France knew that Armstrong, along with everyone, was doping, and people really thought that Gibney had kind of bought into the myth. And so halfway through, Gibney has to do sort of a mea culpa and say, you know, I was kind of taken in, but here's the real story, and it's fascinating.
Does it work as a film? I would think that people are kind of over Lance Armstrong.
I think that's one of the reasons the movie didn't get a lot of traction is because we think of it as an old story that we already know about. But I do think that, you know, doping seems to be an ongoing problem in all sports, so it still seems to be a really relevant documentary to me.
Our final selection is After Tiller.
George Tiller was a target of anti-abortion extremists. His Wichita clinic was bombed in 1985, and then, at the age of 67, he was murdered at church.
The death of Dr. Tiller leaves only 4 doctors in the country who are able to perform late-term abortions.
There was absolutely no question in any of our minds that we were going to keep on doing this work.
Take us out on After Tiller, one of your selections for documentaries of 2013.
This profiles the last 4 third-term abortion doctors in America, how they constantly are facing threats to their lives, how they try to continue doing their work, how they deal with their patients. It's really moving. It's fascinating. Highly recommend it.
And on the podcast this week?
This week, we are going to be looking back at all of the great movies of 2013. That episode's going to be coming out in a few days.
All right. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
true event that rocked the San Francisco Bay Area happened almost 4 years ago. Oscar Grant was fatally shot by a BART police officer in Oakland, California, a young black man shot in the back by a white transit cop just hours after midnight. A life ended at almost the exact moment a new year began.
Let him go!
Grant's death led to widespread protests and rioting in Oakland, questions over police treatment of blacks in the city, and eventually the conviction of that transit police officer. Oscar Grant's story is told in the film Fruitvale Station, the first feature-length film directed by Ryan Coogler. Oscar Grant's last year became the basis for a very good year for a 27-year-old director. Coogler learned growing up in Oakland never to take any good news for granted, though. He says, because it could all be over in an instant.
Certain groups of people live with that a little more than others. Where I'm from is something that we constantly are thinking about, because in the Bay Area, a lot of times young African-American males, you know, we're faced with situations of, you know, gun violence at a higher rate and situations of incarceration at a higher rate. So it's kind of a feeling that you kind of grow up thinking about way too often, that today something might happen where you don't make it home to your loved ones. And in many ways, it influences how we live in ways that are good and ways that are bad, you know. You know, I work in juvenile hall with a lot of kids that live with that reality. And a lot of times they make decisions that aren't judged by immediate gratification because they don't expect to live a long time. It's really interesting, and it's really unfortunate that certain groups of people are living like that. You know?
It's a kind of a tragic wisdom, and it comes through in every one of the performances. I'm wondering, what do you think it was that made people want to live Oscar's story through your film? There was a lot of talk about what's true, what wasn't true, right, how you'd handle the characters. Mm-hmm. In the end, it seems to me the power of the film came from people just wanting to live in his moment outside of news footage. And you gave them an opportunity to do that.
That's kind of like what the power of art is. That's the power of storytelling. You know, so often, you know, people look at a human being outside of the story context. You know, if it wasn't the news footage, and they would look at somebody and see how they looked and see what kind of demographic they come from, and look for ways that they're dissimilar from them. And through those dissimilarities, they won't allow themselves to connect. You know, they'll be able to turn the page when they see a young person is killed, or turn the page when they see there's been a tragedy and, you know, hundreds of lives have been lost in a country that's far removed from theirs. You know, they see it and they say, oh, man, that sucks, but they're able to keep moving forward. But when something happens to somebody in their immediate circle, to somebody who looks like them, somebody who they can relate to, it's devastating. And the cool thing about storytelling is if a story is told well and told with passion that people can connect to, people will connect to it, regardless of their background, regardless of how different they are from the character. You know, it's something that we as human beings do, and it's been proven, you know, time and time again with different stories. And that's kind of one of the biggest reasons that I got into filmmaking, because it's a way to connect with the human condition.
What was the moment, or there are probably more than one, in the edit room where you put something together, where a scene got assembled, and suddenly you weren't talking to the film anymore, the film was talking to you, and you said, wow, this is working in a way that I never even thought?
Well, that's a great question. I would say it would be the scene between Michael B. Jordan and Melanie Diaz, which was Oscar and Sofina. It was the first scene that we shot on set. It was a really complex scene, and we had to do it first, and I was a little nervous about that. And it was a scene about a really intimate situation between these two really young people who are dealing with one of the greatest responsibilities human beings can have, and that's the responsibility of raising a child, you know? And they're still kids themselves.
Daddy?
What?
She's asking for you.
What's up?
I can't sleep.
Can't sleep? You want to sleep in here with Mommy and Daddy?
You know better than that. What time is it?
When that scene started to click, you know, I felt like I was like, man, maybe we got something that people can connect with. I started to see me and my relationships in that scene, and people that were watching, they were saying, you know, the scene's starting to ring true.
What about that scene in front of the fish counter?
the scene in Oscar's job, when he encounters the character Katie, and he's interacting with his, you know, with his best friend who's on the other side and who's still employed.
Need help?
Can I get a pound of your, can you show me what your soul looks like?
Yeah. Soul?
Okay. What about your catfish? Can I see that?
Cat.
Okay, I want to do like a fish fry. Are these ones good to fry?
It's fish. You can fry all of it.
Right. Just give me a second.
Yeah.
So you having a fish fry for New Year's or something?
Well, I'm cooking for a friend tonight before we go to the city, and he loves fried fish, like Southern style. And
Southern? You sound like he's black.
No, he's white, but he knows a lot of black people, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what I got myself into.
I mean, what that scene is about is, you know, Oscar proving that he's worth something to somebody. You know what I mean? Proving that he's loved, proving that he's knowledgeable. You know what I mean? He knows what's going on in the store and how to set her up. And proving that he's worth something kind of showed what kind of guy he was and how complex of a character he was, you know.
So will you always think of Oscar's story every New Year?
Yeah, it's kind of unavoidable. You know, every year they'd have the rally at the bar station. And it's something that marked our whole community. You know, in the Bay Area, what we do is we go over to Frisco. You know, we sit out there on Embarcadero and we watch the fireworks shoot out. I mean, some people drive and they sit in traffic, you know, but most people take public transportation. So it's something that is kind of unavoidable to think about.
Having had such an amazing year that you've had this year, what would you advise somebody who's either looking to have great success next year or is looking to take that next step after a great year this year? What would you advise them?
The advice I have for people that are looking to tell a story that matters to them is just that. You know, tell stories that matter to you. Tell stories that mean the world to you, because making independent films is such a difficult process, you know, that you'll need your passion for the subject matter to be your fuel and to not think that your passions are ridiculous. You know, so many times people would tell me that nobody would care about this film. You know, I would talk to industry professionals and a lot of times in meetings people would say, hey, man, nobody, you know, that's kind of a weird thing to be making a movie about. I say, you know, you can change the name. Nobody really knows about Oscar Grant. You can change that name and do anything with it. You don't have to shoot in the Bay Area. You can set that anywhere. You know, people would give me that kind of advice all the time. And because I'm passionate about the subject matter, I kind of stuck to, you know, what I thought would be best for it. So I would always say to people, you know, tell stories about things that you're personally passionate about, you know.
Well, best of luck to you. And congratulations on a great year.
Oh, thanks so very much. Such an honor to be here talking with you. And it's really great.
Well, the honor is ours. Ryan, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Ryan Coogler is the director of the film Fruitvale Station. You know, we've been having some wonderful conversations over the past several days with people who've had a great year in 2013, and we rarely asked any of them, was this their best year, or can you top this? Have you peaked? Perhaps it was some sense of not wanting to jinx it all, bring a note of bad luck to someone else's great moment. But it got us thinking about some years and moments. 1979 was a great year for young actress Meryl Streep when she won the Oscar for her role in the film Kramer vs. Kramer. But it was no peak. 17 nominations later, she won her third Oscar this year for The Iron Lady.
But also I want to thank, because I really understand I'll never be up here again. I thank you, all of you. For this, you know, inexplicably wonderful career. Thank you so much. Thank you.
So that is a peak. She thinks so anyway. Hey, what was this guy thinking in 2011? Peak moment?
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda.
How do presidents evaluate such things as good years, bad years, peak years? Can they? How about presidential candidates?
Well, this isn't exactly the party I planned, but I sure like the company.
Okay, 2008, as close as Hillary Clinton will ever get to the White House? Maybe. Maybe not.
I'm retiring, man. I'm just going to take some time. I think I'm probably going to quit music.
And you can hear it there. Justin Bieber wants to stop peaking. All these good years are killing him, he says. But for Edward Snowden, there will never be another change-the-world moment to match this year, 2013.
I don't want to live in a world where everything that I say, everything I do, everyone I talk to, every expression of creativity or love or friendship is recorded.
Peak moment, best year. Can we know when the best years are behind us? Todd May is a philosophy professor at Clemson University, and he wrote an op-ed for our partner, the New York Times, where he took a look at how great years for an Edward Snowden or an NFL player share a certain similarity that he calls the weight of the past. Todd May, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, John.
Now, let me just establish right at the top here. Is the reason that you started thinking about this notion of peaking, of are the best years behind us, me, you, have anything to do with the fact that you're approaching 60?
I think so. I would say it's right now a combination of a couple of things. One, I'm getting older. My kids are getting older. So I think I start thinking about things because of that. And on the other hand, there was a convergence in the news of Ed Snowden, his revelations, what's happened to him, and the concussions that occur to NFL players.
And I'd like to talk about Edward Snowden particularly, and perhaps, you know, Peyton Manning and some others in the NFL particularly. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's interesting about your article is that you try to separate out this notion of a peak year, a good year, and this idea that your best years are behind you and that you're much more thinking about a broad trajectory and trend line that's either up or down. What do you see as the distinctions between those various descriptions of a good year?
One thing I think we need to keep in mind is that lives aren't just collections of moments. Was it Henry Ford who said it was one damn thing after another when he was talking about history? Right? Lives have these trajectories. And in these trajectories, there are commitments, relationships, projects that have their peaks. And then we have periods which are not so much like that. And I think during those periods, we can begin to wonder whether it will ever be as it was before. And what I'm suggesting here is not nostalgia. Nostalgia, in a way, is giving up, saying, well, it's never going to be any better. But rather that we live our lives, we live our trajectory with a certain uncertainty about whether we will be able to achieve the kinds of contributions or accomplishments that we have before. And that could be with early accomplishments like, say, Peyton Manning in the NFL, or let's say a parent who gives birth to their kids, they raise their kids, the kids go off, and one wonders whether the intensity of relationship will be there down the road.
And let's take the Snowden case for a second. I mean, there's certainly no chance that he's going to burst on the scene again as he did this year. But it's certainly conceivable that as time passes, he will acquire an influence that could give him as big a year, say, in 10 years as he had this year.
Particularly with Ed Snowden, that would be more difficult. He's the kind of person that I think the U.S. government is going to try to ensure doesn't have the kind of influence that he has had on public debate. Perhaps a more interesting case would be with NFL players who sometimes can go on and make meaningful lives and peaks in other areas of their lives, although many of them don't.
Well, talking about Peyton Manning, he had great years, then he went away with a serious injury, came back right this year, and is having an absolute career year. Yet, for most of the experience of people in the NFL, it's their body selling them out over a period of 6 years, and when it goes, it goes.
Yes, and I think there's another aspect to this as well. I've read some interviews with former NFL players, ones who've had serious injuries or even ramifications from concussions, at least in the interviews I've read, all of the players have said they would do it again. They would pay the price that they're paying now to have had the experience that they had then.
So let me just, before we go, quiz you on some big names who may or may not have peaked. But based on your gut instinct, has Barack Obama peaked?
What I'm going to do, John, is I'm going to duck this question. And the reason I'm going to duck it is that part of what I wanted to insist on in the piece is that we don't know whether our lives have fully peaked. In some cases, and Barack Obama would probably be one of those cases where it's most likely that there's a peak, but yet and still, for most of us, I suspect the answer is that we don't really know whether there's a peak.
And would you say that a fantastic year on the part of a filmmaker, an entertainer, an athlete, or an Edward Snowden is a good thing, or does it make it harder for you to navigate the years ahead?
You know, and maybe both. If we didn't have great years like that, in some sense, we might have a little bit less resonance in our own lives. But the uncertainty and perhaps the probability in some cases that we won't be able to achieve that again may be the price that we pay.
And as a tenured professor, is the definition of tenure that the best years are behind you, or is your best work ahead of you?
Well, I don't know whether my best work is ahead of me. I've done work that I think is good but not great. I don't think tenure is going to be a significant dividing line. What tenure really gives you is the opportunity to start pursuing what you really want to do. But whether I've got more in me or more and more and better in me is something I don't really know.
But that uncertainty, I think, is a sense of excitement and hope, and even gives me energy thinking about that. So, Todd May, good luck in the next couple of years.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on the program.
And have a great year. Happy New Year to Todd May, professor of philosophy at Clemson University. Thanks so much.
And a happy new year and a happy further trajectory to you, John.
This is Trixie from the East Village. I've had a fabulous life so far, but my best years aren't behind me, not by any means. My past has shaped me and helped me make me who I am today. And the future is mine to make of what I will. Bring it on.
Go, Trixie. You want to go there? Have you peaked? Are the best years ahead of you or behind you? Share your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. Todd Zulick will be in for me early next week. I'll be back on New Year's Day. Thanks so much for listening. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.